You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko India tōku ingoa, nō mai, haere mai, ki te wai mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, welcome to The Wire for Tuesday the 7th of November. I'm joined by my producer Lucy in studio on this beautiful day. How are you, Lucy?
Yep.
Hi. If I turn your mic on, that might help. There you go.
I'm really good, thanks, India.
That is good. We have a really cool show today. I think we said that last week, but
yeah, we did.
It's turning our own horn. Anyway, coming up on the show today, we speak to Oxfam about the Paradise Papers, a huge document leak which reveals how the world's elite use offshore havens to avoid paying tax. Dr. Jackie Blue from the Human Rights Commission discusses Labor's changes to paid parental leave and the Equal Pay Act. On the Green Desk, we have a new host, Connor Mercer, and we hear about shallow reef systems and the importance of citizen scientists. We speak to Greer Rasmussen from Women in Urbanism about the importance of accessibility in Auckland's transport. And illustrator Toby Morris discusses ethics in cartoons, following a controversy around two Fairfax pieces that have been labelled by some as racist and unfair. As always, if you want to let us know your thoughts on any issues we cover, please give us a call 309 3879 or tuku pātuhi mai, send us a text on 5395.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Global development organisation Oxfam says New Zealand has a chance to lead the charge against global tax avoidance following the revelations brought to light by the Paradise Papers, which reveal how the world's wealthiest use offshore havens to avoid paying tax. Journalists across multiple organisations have been working for a year on the papers, which include over 13 million leaked documents in total, making it the largest data leak in history. Those implicated in the documents include the Queen, the Canadian Prime Minister's fundraiser, one of Donald Trump's cabinet secretaries, and donors to the UK Conservative Party. Trump and Theresa May are facing questions over the links, as they have both pledged to clamp down on tax avoidance. Oxfam New Zealand says the Paradise Papers are clear evidence of an unjust global tax system that allows the wealthy to avoid paying their fair share of tax, fueling poverty and inequality. I spoke to Oxfam New Zealand's executive director, Rachel Lemazurier, about the revelations, and she began by explaining what the Paradise Papers are and how they came to light.
The Paradise Papers are a huge volume. I think it's over 13 million documents that have arrived as a leak, a set of leaked documents, to originally a group of German journalists who then made it available to the International Council of Investigative Journalism, who were then joined by The Guardian and I think also Panorama, who have spent probably 8 to 9 months going through it in detail, and that's what we've got now. Well, the leaked documents came from particularly one large company that is, primarily a legal firm, that is set up specifically just to help people find ways to be able to avoid taxes. Now, we have to remember that means it's legal, but when you take the whole planet, it's about looking to find where in the world can someone register their business as being based, and therefore that's where they pay taxes. And so ideally, this company has gone out of its way to find all the places where there's very little tax to be paid. And a lot of the correspondence backwards and forwards between multinationals and extremely super rich people is actually in these documents.
And it's interesting to see that they implicate some very high profile people, including Donald Trump and Theresa May and Justin Trudeau's advisor, who have all people who are all have said that this is an issue they want to crack down on. So it's kind of interesting that, you know, they're saying this, but in practice, they're actually sort of complicit in the issue.
Well, one of the things that Oxfam is asking for is more transparency. And I think that it is about ensuring that there isn't hypocrisy amongst our political leaders, or even amongst some of the multinationals who's in the past have said that they pay their fair share of taxes. And yet then you do hear that Apple has worked very hard to find ways to be able to pay far less, even though that when they were under pressure to pay fair tax back in 2013, they looked all over the place to find somewhere and set up something specifically in Guernsey, to avoid paying fair tax. So I think it's legal, but it's not fair.
So how do you see this, like how should this be addressed? Does it need to be changing the laws? Does it need to be sort of a perception change? Or what's the best course of action?
There's a whole range of things that have been flowing, really flowing from the Panama Papers and some of the leaks before then. And it is, first and foremost, a growing sense of it being unfair, and that whilst it may be the law, it's actually not moral and not fair when so many of us pay our fair share of taxes, and taxes are what are used to help hospitals and schools and our roading system and law and order. And particularly for Oxfam, that's in developing countries. So what we're seeing is a growing understanding around the world, whether you're in a developing country or in a country like New Zealand, where it's just not okay for this to carry on. So transparency, and that's particularly what Oxfam is asking for, is something called public country-by-country reporting by multinationals, so that we can tell how much they earn in a country and how much tax they pay in that country. And that actually relates to New Zealand in particular. Secondly, we're also looking, and there's been some movement in the EU, around ending tax havens, or at least beginning to be able to build the list of unacceptable tax havens, like a blacklist. And there's very few on that list right now, and it's about actually moving more into that becomes unacceptable. I think thirdly, we're very, very aware too that that countries such as New Zealand are setting up tax working groups, and it's about seeing what is feasible to be able to both reduce the amount of legal tax avoidance. After all, the law is passed by our government, so we can actually change law. It's not like it's written in stone. So this is something that as members of our communities and voters all around the world are in a position to be able to put some pressure on our government to say, so if the law allows this to happen, why don't we change some of the laws?
I guess after the Panama Papers, there was a lot of talk around this. And earlier this year, there was talk around multinational tax avoidance, specifically in New Zealand. Do you think that this is big enough to make changes to how this works?
I think the key thing is that there's no one silver bullet. So whilst there it is that the Panama Papers did get some change, it was barely scratching the surface. So the Paradise Papers are going to let us go a little bit deeper into below the surface, but still not quite enough. It has to be ongoing. And as I said, it's about our governments changing laws. It's also some of the moral pressures. So we're consumers of some of these products of these multinationals. And as consumers, we've got significant power. And as consumers, we're actually living in India and in Papua New Guinea. And so some of us are able in those countries, particularly our Oxfam partners, to put pressure on a moral basis, not just a legal one. And I think and more too is the work that the journalists are doing, which is just extraordinary, to be able to pile through all these millions of documents to help us understand more about what has been really incredibly secretive, and in that case, very underhand. And what's emerging is whilst many have been saying this is legal, what we are beginning to understand, it's very mixed up with what's illegal. And very difficult to understand the difference between what is legal and what's illegal, because it is very smoke and mirrors. So what the journalists are doing are helping us all around the world begin to understand what parts of organisations like Apple and others have done and is legal, and what parts actually are illegal.
So what do you think New Zealand's role in this should be?
Well, I think we've got a new government, and I think that it was a really good step that the national government did with the foreign tax rules being changed. And it's really clear that how New Zealand is seen by others is that there has been real scope for things like the foreign trusts to allow people who don't have necessarily the best interests at heart to use. So New Zealand can and will, and the tax working group should be looking at what we can do within our own laws to make tax more fair, though it's not that we're talking about extreme scenarios in New Zealand, but at a global level, that's where it really kicks in, and that's where New Zealand can be part of some of the progressive governments that are putting pressure to put on the global tax system to make it more fair. That's, for example, coming in behind the tax havens blacklist, coming in behind what is seen as the, it's called BEPS, but it's the Base Erosion and Profit Sharing scheme that the G20 has brought in, so, progress that further. So at a global level, this is about trying to reduce the amount of places that multinationals can really hide their money. I think it's really fair to say that this is about extreme wealth. You know, Oxfam, and it's not about people getting wealthier. It's about extreme wealth. And the extreme wealth in many cases is beyond most of New Zealanders' comprehension. And it's just not fair that that money is being diverted really for the benefit of the extremely wealthy and the multinationals.
It's not just the money that's being diverted, it's also an immense amount of money that's being spent diverting it as well.
That's right, exactly. And it's actually $100 billion that's been diverted. And I think it's also just really, it's about good standards and good practice and saying that we're much better than this. Where we earn money is where we should be paying taxes.
Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
It is 12:13, and after this we are back looking at Labour's changes to paid parental leave.
Can anyone explain why the modern day whales are so big?
The Wire.
Yesterday, Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern announced a plan to increase paid parental leave to 22 weeks by July 2018 and 26 weeks by 2020. The bill will be introduced to Parliament tomorrow and is expected to pass with the support of New Zealand First and the Greens. The Human Rights Commission have welcomed the decision, while Business New Zealand has raised concerns about small businesses having trouble retaining staff after taking time off. This morning I spoke to Dr. Jackie Blue, Equal Opportunities Commissioner for the Human Rights Commission, about why they support paid parental leave being increased and her take on the criticism.
It's good for mothers, and particularly it's very good for babies as far as their health goes and development goes, and really important for bonding. And it will actually help support getting strong families.
If there are so many benefits to come out of it, why was this initially taken off the table, do you think?
Oh, you mean when it was vetoed by the former government? We'd have to ask them. I think it was a financial reason that they vetoed it. But I'm pleased that it was picked up by opposition parties and is now part of government policy and about to go through Parliament, I think today or tomorrow.
And you also raised an interesting point that it's important that parenting is still supported by fathers. Is this helps to decrease the gender pay gap? Is that a factor? Oh. So how do you think these two things need to interact?
Well, I think this was the first thing to get the 6 months paid parental leave for women in New Zealand. It's the World Health Organization gold standard, and we've been lagging behind, so it's good to get that on track. By 2020, the next thing that needs to happen is that men need to have their own paid parental leave in their own right, as many Nordic countries are doing, and they has worked well and is well received. And that's because men need to take up their share of child rearing and unpaid work. In actual fact, the men who are taking paid parental leave love it. They want to do it. They want to take part in bringing up their children. It's good for children. They see gender equality being normalised, and it's good on so many levels. It's good for them as employees. They're more satisfied, more productive when they go back to work. It's just good all around.
I could imagine as a father you'd feel like you're missing out if you're at work.
Exactly. And the men this day and age do want to take part. They are missing out. They don't want to carry on those normal stereotype roles when men go out, earn the money, and women stay at home, bring up the children. They really want to do their fair share.
So I saw that Business New Zealand has come out with a bit of criticism that small businesses might be put in a difficult position where staff don't return after 26 weeks. Do you see this as being an issue?
Look, it happens now with 18 weeks. Women will make a decision that's different from what they thought of before they took time off. They may find they really want to spend much longer with their child and be prepared to take unpaid leave for that. So, or they feel that when they do return to work, they won't return to the work that they originally came to. They may want to go to a different type of work, part-time or whatever. So it's happening now anyway at 18 weeks. So I think the comment was made, it may be easier for employers to find someone to do their job for 6 months as opposed to the current 18 weeks. We can't preempt what women are going to do once they actually are at home with their new baby, and obviously they can change their minds.
So you don't really see it as being a bigger problem than the issues that come up now?
It's already happening now. It's already happening now.
And in terms of the Equal Pay Act, you've also come out supporting that this is good, that this is being readdressed. What were the main issues that you had with the original legislation?
Nothing's been passed. It's been proposed. It's gone through first reading, but the bill that was tabled at Parliament and that had gone through first reading was flawed. It wasn't true to the joint working group principles, which were agreed by business, union and government, which if they had followed that, it would have been amazing legislation. The principles said quite clearly there had to be equitable access for women to make a pay equity claim. So women, no matter what job they were in, they would be able to easily access labour market details to analyse if their claim had merit. They'd be able to analyse and go back and find historical data to confirm their pay claim had merit. They'd be able to get legal advice. Now, for women who are part of a union, that isn't a problem. The union will do those claims on behalf of them. But for individual women or small groups who are not in a union, that would be impossible. The bill that was tabled in Parliament did not address that. And the bill had a hierarchy of comparators. The joint working group was silent on this. They couldn't agree amongst themselves what if there should be male comparators, so they were silent. And the government added in a principle that when assessing a pay equity claim, that a male comparator had to be used within that particular work site that had to be checked out of that. If they couldn't find a suitable male comparator, they had to go within the industry, and if that couldn't be worked out, they had to go to the wider labour market. And the concern was that could be challenged at every step, could be very protracted, and the claim would not go anywhere. So, but and also I think the current bill can be improved. It is currently a complaint-based system where a woman has to go to her employer and say, look, I think I've been underpaid. And for many women, that may be very difficult. There may be a power imbalance between the employer and the worker, and they feel they can't go to the employer and ask that or state that for a whole variety of reasons. The issue is that we would like to see a positive duty of care for employers. So it's not the woman's responsibility to go to the employer and say, I've got an issue with pay equity here. We would like the employer to have this positive duty to actually go and check that their employees are paid fairly in the first place. And the second thing, there's no mechanism for pay transparency. Women have got no idea if they are being underpaid. There's no mechanism to check that.
So basically, yeah, it's just a bit too complicated, and it should be really up to employers to look at whether they're being a fair organisation rather than a case-by-case basis with employees.
I think the complaint-based system is probably the most important point, because if they are checking and doing checks and audits regularly, they will see if one group is lagging behind as far as work ethic responsibility goes to ensure that they are paid fairly.
That was Equal Employment Opportunities Commissioner Dr. Jackie Blue speaking about why the Human Rights Commission supports an increase to paid parental leave and also changes to the Equal Pay Act. It is 12:24. After this, we are back with the Green Desk.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire. Orcon presents 2017's IRL finale. In real life, end of year at Golden Dawn, November 19th. Another year older, another year deeper into the morass of political ridiculousness. Your hosts, Russell Brown, Joe Guy Bart, and their stellar guests relive the year that was in a bar with an exclusive performance from Julia Deans. Orcon IRL end of year, Golden Dawn, November 19th, 4 to 7 p.m., free entry. And if you can't make it, IRL is live streamed thanks to Orcon Internet and the fine folk here at BFM. RSVP at publicaddress.net.
Oh, you goddamn poo, you just crashed into my Mazda Demio.
I crashed into you. You crashed into me.
No, you merged incorrectly. Merged like a zipper. Z-I-P-P-A.
I was merging like a zipper.
Not like any zip I've ever seen.
What kind of zip goes 232?
The kind of zips we have in Kohimarama. What are you doing? Don't know the road.
All your clothes fall apart.
What are you listening to?
I'm listening to BFM Drive.
Oh my god, I'm listening to BFM Drive.
Shut up.
No, I won't shut up. I love it so much.
Shut
I'm not talking
up.
About it.
It's
my favourite
it.
Radio station
it's
thing.
It's my favourite too. Hey.
What are you doing?
Should we get married?
Oh my god, are you down on one knee?
Will you marry me?
Of course I will. Oh my god, this is the best day of my life.
I'm so happy. Oh my god, I have to call my mum.
Yeah, what's her name?
Tammy.
Cute. Should we take your car or mine?
I don't know if either of them will drive.
Taxi.
Let's get an Uber.
You can come back there. Nice.
Good shit happens when you let BFM drive into your precious automobile. Every weekday from 4 till 7, Johnny and Big Hungry sweeten the blow of your homeward commute with all the good features and all the good tunes to keep you ticking along. BFM Drive with Johnny and Big Hungry, every weekday from 4 till 7.
Make yourself a oneness with the loving earth. It's time for the Green Desk with Lily Peacock on 95 BFM.
This week on the Green Desk, we have Connor Mercer and the effect that the ocean warming can have on shallow reef systems as fish from warmer climates begin to explore further towards the poles. Connor spoke with Mark Costello from the University of Auckland about a recent report coming from data collected by the Reef Life Survey. We started by asking him to expand on the findings of the data.
Yes, this is one of several papers they've had coming out, but in this one they looked at the abundance of fish using standard surveys on reefs around the world. So they set up a citizen science organization, basically a private society, which organizes everything. They have a standard methodology where divers lay out a line down along the seashore at about 3 to 15 meters. And then they count the numbers of fish at intervals down the line, and they count large mobile things like starfish and sea urchins, sea cucumbers, crabs, crayfish along the transect as well. So they have this comparison between the fish and the bottom living invertebrates. And the new thing here was that when we looked at the overall data running from the most northern to southern parts of the globe, we see a decrease in fish in the colder waters because fish being cold-blooded are more active and hungry in warmer waters. And in those warmer waters, they tend to dominate the whole environment. So they're the top predators, they're the mid-level predators, and they're probably some of the dominant plant-eating animals as well. So it means the invertebrates don't get a chance. So then when you look in the Antarctic and colder regions of the world, you suddenly see this huge diversity of different types of crustaceans and crabs and starfish, all just sitting there waiting for food. And they're not being attacked by fish because the fish aren't so hungry or as abundant. So this is the first time we've actually seen a kind of a gradient in ecological change, which is linked with temperature, because temperature is what drives the fish appetite and activity and dominance of the ecosystem.
These fish that are venturing further because the water is getting warmer and they're able to get more energy and get out there, are they leaving purely because the water is warming, or are they being forced out of their environments?
Very good question. We suspect it's a bit of both. So actually, on average, more species will expand their geographic range due to climate warming, because they're moving into the waters that were previously too cold for them. Or they're just increasing their abundance in those waters that are too cold. You know, if the water's too cold, they'll grow slowly and they'll reproduce slowly, so they'll be lower abundance. But in some separate research we've done, we see a decrease in species rich numbers of species around the equator. So we think this is due to the equator just getting that bit too hot, and it's stressing the fish and other species. So you might have seen the media stories about coral bleaching, which is another sign of stress. So the corals are getting too hot. If it's too hot for too many days, they basically end up dying. Yeah, so it's a bit of both.
I wanted to ask, as we see water temperatures rise globally, how is this likely to affect New Zealand, even at the day-to-day level? Is this likely to affect people's experience over summer, out fishing and enjoying the beach? Is it going to change the way we experience our water life?
Yes, it will. And once you get down to local scales, it gets a little harder to predict. So the studies we've been looking at have been looking at global scale data, which you can see some good general patterns. But at a local scale, things are very different. So, for example, the northeast of New Zealand, the temperature here has hardly changed with climate warming so far. And it's predicted not to change as much as the south of New Zealand. So those guys down in Dunedin and places are likely to see more dramatic changes in their ecosystems than we may see in the Hauraki Gulf. So that's one of the interesting things about climate warming, is that it's not evenly distributed around the world. So at a global level, the northern hemisphere is really where a lot of the warming is occurring, in the North Atlantic and North Pacific oceans, more so than in the Southern Ocean. Perhaps because the Southern Ocean is such a large body of water, it takes longer to warm up.
There's another thing about this project, is that the sheer size of it means that we're able to compare and contrast data from all around the world now. I understand that there's a data collection with over 4,000 species with information from over 50 countries.
Yeah.
That's a huge task. How does this get done? Who's funding this and who's organising it?
Well, it's the brainchild of Graeme Edgar and Rick Stewart-Smith and the University of Tasmania. So they really led it and got some funding in Australia. And they've been organising this now for over 10 years. So it's been quite amazing, really. And I guess one of the innovations they had was they didn't try to do this like a standard scientific project where you get funding and do the project and then it ends, or you try to get more funding. They've made this much more sustainable by involving a global community of interested scuba divers from all walks of life. And they've set up a kind of a standard methodology where people can go to the website, join in, and then see when they're available to take part in surveys.
So the kind of people that are out there helping organise these surveys, they're not necessarily trained scientists, they're just citizens that are interested in marine life.
Yeah, now actually most of them, when they actually look at this, have had some scientific background. Either they went to university or they're...
So they've picked up an interest in it from somewhere?
Yeah, they picked up an interest somewhere. Either from scuba diving, because a lot of the scuba diving clubs and courses often teach people a bit about marine biology, or they're just interested in fish and fishing, and so they have that interest already. They also have sailboat owners and other people involved in the marine industry, tourism operators. You know, a lot of people are now employed to take people scuba diving, so that it becomes more interesting if they can explain more about the environment. And then they like to get a little bit more skilled but they'll contribute to these scientific surveys.
When this project started, was there a specific goal in mind, a question that they were looking to answer, such as what we've been talking about today and the spread of invertebrates compared to fish around the world? Or is this something that has just been picked up in the data as it's gone along?
Yes and no again. So we didn't expect to find this result. They found some of the other results they did expect to find. And one of the gaps in a lot of global science is finding standard methods so you can compare results between different areas. And they built on other standard methods used in the tropics, especially for scuba diving surveys. But they realized that these were, you know, they weren't sustainable because they were kind of project to project and they were too localized. So they tried to develop something that would show the global picture. But of course, this also shows the local picture. So there's been studies and separate papers on their findings in northeastern New Zealand and parts of Australia. So it's kind of a win-win because you get the local story, plus you get regional and global stories all from the same methodology by standardizing it and a bit like franchising it, I guess.
You've been listening to The Green Desk with Lily Peacock on 95 BFM.
That was Connor Mercer speaking to Mark Costello from the University of Auckland. After this, we are back looking at ethics in cartoons.
I don't know, and frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Two controversial Fair Facts cartoons depicting people abusing the food in schools programs have once again come under fire. Labour MP Louisa Wall is appealing a Human Rights Tribunal decision that the two cartoons published in the Marlborough Express and the Press in 2013 didn't bring Māori or Pacifica into contempt. Wall says the cartoons were racist and an unfair depiction of vulnerable people, and she's appealing the decision in the High Court. But these are just the latest in a string of cartoons over the years which have drawn debate over their characterisation of minority groups. Producer Max Smith spoke to spin-off cartoonist Toby Morris about the issue, who said the 2013 cartoons were disgusting but also part of a broader trend in the media.
Where do I start? I mean, I thought they were pretty offensive. Just lazy, really. Like, I think it's just a lazy kind of stereotype to go for. I think they kind of, how do I put this? I don't think they're challenging like a stereotype. They're reinforcing a stereotype that I think is really sort of a sloppy thing to, it's not a, sort of a pretty weak kind of point, I thought, to make, and for not much effect, I didn't think. I don't know. I don't see who was going to, what they were hoping to achieve by drawing those cartoons.
Is that then, you think, part of what cartoons should achieve, challenging stereotypes or conventional dialogue?
Yeah, I mean, I think cartoons should be there to challenge things and to ask questions and to kind of poke and prod at things that are, you know, worth kind of poking and prodding about. But I think that should be, I think in a way you should be sort of, I think of it anyway, that it should be challenging conventional thinking or challenging the sort of the status quo on things, not necessarily reinforcing the status quo. I think you have to, I think I have to, for me, when I'm drawing a cartoon about something, I have to have actually properly thought it through, and that feel the sort of the attitude expressed in those cartoons felt like a real sort of knee-jerk gut kind of thing, that if you sat and thought about it properly and did some reading and actually kind of thought it through properly, I think you'd come to a different kind of conclusion. I think they were kind of a real surface level kind of, yeah, just kind of knee-jerk depiction of an existing stereotype that I don't think really helps anybody.
Do you think there's perhaps a market or an appreciation for this kind of blame-inducing kind of cartoons?
Yeah, I think there's always a bit of a distinction to, like, I think there's sort of a blurry line between people just sort of, you know, people often sort of bring up the free speech thing as like it being really good to provoke debate and it being really good that we can say anything and you know, we should be able to challenge, you know, have any kind of conversation, like nothing should be off limits in terms of thing. And with that, I think it's easy to confuse kind of like shock value or, you know, being edgy or something as this kind of great quality in itself, you know. But I think if you're not using that, and I think that's fine to use sort of shock value or be confrontational in a way, but I think it should be, I think you just have to use that kind of power for good, you know. Like, I think if you're using it to pick on people that are in a more vulnerable position than you, or that are the weakest people in society. I mean, who wants a call out to put the boot in on children in poverty? You know, like, who's sitting there thinking, like, I know who we need to, like, knock down a peg? Those disadvantaged children, you know, like, it's such a sort of a gutless move, I think, to use that sort of shock thing to do that. So I think I don't think it's bad in itself to be shocking or to be provocative. I think it's fine for cartoons to be provocative, but I think it should be, I guess in a way it's sort of the whole like punching up, punching down thing, you know, like I don't think you should, to me, I don't want to take aim at people that are in a more vulnerable position than myself. Like, I don't think there's anything for me, it's just sort of just bullying, I think, at a certain point if you're just taking pot shots at people who are already struggling, you know.
Is that not just kind of a result, though, of what is the traditional form of cartoons, which is this kind of mocking, you know, the use of caricatures and so forth to make a mockery of whoever is depicted in that cartoon? I mean, do you think that's a problem that needs to be addressed?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's a problem. It is something that cartoonists, a line that cartoonists walk all the time is you're right. It has a history of coming from a place of like poking fun at things and mocking things, and often that's been, I mean, if you look back, that's usually been like at people in positions of power. You know, like you can mock the king, or you can mock the prime minister, or you can mock someone that's too big for their boots and doesn't realise that they're out of touch or something. But I just think you just have to be careful that you're not using it to stomp on people that don't that don't deserve to be, that don't, you know, there's nothing to be gained from sort of challenging, you know. And even then, having said that, I feel like, for me personally, I know every other cartoonist is different, but for me, I have kind of shied away a little bit from that mocking thing. Like, I feel increasingly uncomfortable about that as time goes on. I think there is a bit of a shift where, say, you know, if I was drawing a cartoon about Jerry Brownlee or Paula Bennett, maybe 20 years ago it would have been more acceptable to make a sort of a joke about their weight, say, just for example, where I think these days, like, I think that's a bit of a cheap shot, and it's not really, it's sort of beside the point for me to say, you know, if I'm criticising something that they've done, for me to just sort of build into the joke that jokes about someone's physical appearance or all that kind of thing. So in a way, for me, for just first other cartoonists would probably still more enjoy putting the boot in on things and having a licence to do that. But I just think there's no reason to, kind of, like, there's nothing. I'd rather make I've got other points to make other than, like, sort of just mocking people for the sake of things that they can't control necessarily.
Right, and some would call that censorship, right? Cartoons becoming more politically correct. But you're saying that it's them becoming more constructive with what they're trying to get across.
Yeah, or just more considered, like, just more thoughtful, I think. I think for me, like, I think things work better when I have thought something through rather than just have a sort of a knee-jerk, like, this person's ugly or something, you know? Like, it's just, it's kind of basic and dumb to take those easy pot shots. If I'm sort of challenged to think of things, so think things through in a way that's not just, like, just mocking people for their, for the real basic stuff, I think it makes the points more interesting and just not being a dick, basically.
To understand the dick distinction, Rewire.
Join us for our next Late at Auckland Museum. Sing it, sister. Aotearoa has a wonderful heritage of strong female pop, but what have female musicians been up against in order to make it? How have they turned challenge into success? Hear from our moderator, Rose Matafeo, and panellists Lady Six, Diane Swan, BFM's own Geneva Alexander Masters, and Jessie Moss. Book now, Late at the Auckland Museum. Sing it, sister, on this Wednesday. Tickets are on sale now at aucklandmuseum.com.
Do you ever think about space? How it's just, you know, so unknowable and awesome?
I guess so. I guess I get confused about what's still a planet.
I know, right? Oh, and the stars, the insignificance of, like, us?
Yeah, yeah. Hey, speaking of space, I'm the only person on this whole bus. You don't need to sit right here on my lap.
Sorry, I was thinking about the cold, unknowable void.
Spaced out. David Britton from Auckland Stardome Observatory and Planetarium talks everything spacey on Spaced Out. Every other Tuesday on 95 BFM Drive.
Ah,
yalla yalla yalla, yalla 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 yalla. There's jumble around about who tonight in the groove. In the streets of fear, forgetting all those best taekwondo moves on a barrel of beer. Trying to get a signal through from Ragger FM to the TTI bus, CNN, sucking this wine right out of the vine, and I'd spin it back again. Grooving, let's cut out of the scene, go grooving. Grooving, let's cut out of the scene, go grooving. Drive, drive. This is no object
Urban planning and transport is usually seen as a uniform, one-size-fits-all thing. One group that is challenging this is Women in Urbanism, a group that is pushing to make transport more accessible to women and people in need. Jack Marshall had a chat to Jia Rasmussen from Women in Urbanism about this.
I have been volunteering for about 2 years with Generation Zero, and then more recently I helped to start up Women in Urbanism Aotearoa, which is a group currently of only young women, but we're open to anyone joining. And our mission is to transform our cities and towns into more beautiful, inspiring and inclusive places for everyone. And the way that we plan to do this is by amplifying the voices and actions of all self-identifying women and girls in the realm of city planning and city building.
What would some like examples, like real life examples of this be? Because I can kind of think of, you know, designing a city for like females at night. You'd want to have somewhere where you could actually have like a good view of the area and things like that. But what are the kind of examples does your organisation put forward?
Yeah, so there's a lot of great examples in Auckland that you can sort of look at. I think the fact that we're so focused on motorway building is a really clear example of where women-friendly design hasn't really been thought about, because, you know, many women, especially low-income women, don't have unlimited access to a car, so they may be sharing a car with family members or with their partner. So we can look sort of more recently into the Norwestern motorway where, you know, there was no sort of public transport added in when that was rebuilt. The East-West Link that's being proposed is purely a motorway for commuters and for businesses, so there isn't going to be any sort of public transport links that address the needs of ordinary people. I think sort of some smaller examples are maybe the Norwestern Cycleway, which, I mean, it's great that we have a cycleway there, but it's very dark at night. There's lots of high fences around. So if you got into trouble or someone attacked you, there's no one around to help you.
Mm, definitely. And yeah, it was funnily enough, I saw the organisation Greater Auckland. They just tweeted out a picture of Auckland Transport's board of directors, and it's like 10 exactly the same photos of just like middle-aged white men. Just kind of, this is like a good example for me of where things like diversity are, like, it's very clear that diversity would help this like immediately, because then it would put a different perspective that obviously they're just not thinking about.
Yeah, I think they actually got that photo from us. I think Emma, one of our members, tweeted that. But I think, you know, not only is there no women in that photo, but there's also, you know, Auckland's one of the most multicultural cities in the world, but it's, you know, majority white men. Auckland's, you know, there's a lot of young people in Auckland, but there's no younger people in that photo. So yes, it's important that women's voices are heard, but like we're also advocating that a whole spectrum of different voices is heard from what currently is out there.
These kind of things you're advocating for, is there like a list or like a manifesto that you'd like to see put forward? Or if, for example, what would you kind of implement straight away?
I guess we're a pretty new group, but there's a couple of sort of big key issues that we do want to focus on. I think a big one for Auckland, and we're not just an Auckland focus group, we do have starting to have little national branches in other cities like Wellington and Christchurch. But I think for Auckland, the key issue for us really is density, because when we have a more dense city, that makes it much easier to have better public transport and also to invest in walking and cycling infrastructure. We also feel that the urban sprawl that's currently being built in Auckland is not really serving women. It's also not serving minority people, people with disabilities. A range of different groups are being disadvantaged by it because it pushes our communities apart. Even though it is building new houses, it doesn't really contribute to affordability in any sort of effective way. And it also makes these people that isolated in the suburbs, they don't have access to amenities, they don't have access to transport to get around. Women who are traditionally in caregiving roles often are made to be taxi drivers for family members, whether it's children or older relatives, because they can't get around by themselves in those areas. So that's, density is definitely one of the big issues. I think cycling is a big one for us. Only 30% of cyclists in Auckland are female currently. The current cycling infrastructure that we see in Auckland and in Wellington, which is mostly just painted lanes, it doesn't cater to the needs of women, children or other disadvantaged people. For those types of people to feel confident cycling, we need a connected network of separated Copenhagen-style lanes. And I mean, I think this is a really good example of how this women-friendly perspective will actually benefit everyone, because if we have separated lanes, there'll be less accidents, more people out on bikes and not in their cars, which means less congestion and traffic. I think protected cycleways are also a really important one for us, because a lot of us in the group are cyclists and have experienced harassment when we're cycling. I, a couple of months ago, got a full can of beer thrown at me while I was cycling. Yeah, and I think like by having protected cycleways, by making space for cyclists on the road, we're showing car drivers that cyclists have a right to the road and therefore they're less likely to be harassed.
Yeah, it's definitely a kind of, I cycle a lot as well, and it's kind of this impression that when you're a cyclist, you're in the car's space, it's not your space. And so,
yeah. And I mean, legally, like, we all have equal right to be on the road, but that's not how drivers perceive it.
The Wire.
Sitting on the beach watching transnational criminal scum neoliberal filth.
That was The Wire.
That brings us to the end of our show for another week. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us during the show today. Dr. Jackie Blue, Rachel Lemazurier, Mark Costello, Greer Rasmussen, and Toby Morris. A big thanks to my producers, Lucy.
That's all right, India.
Thank you, India. Mac, Connor, and Jack as well. They all helped with the show. And thanks for being with us. We'll be back next week. Jenna's up next with the 1 to 4.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.